You're listening to Melting Pot here every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. on Radio Powered by the People, KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. My name is Michael Barnes, and I'm your host for this program, and I'd now like to pay tribute to an exceptional work of art, one of my favorite albums of all time, Talk Talk's Laughingstock, released 20 years ago in 1991. It's a record that I first heard in Atlanta on WRES Album 88 when I was in high school, and by sheer happenstance, I'd recorded a song from this album, Ascension Day, on a cassette, but had no idea who the artist was. It took me another 4 or 5 years before I finally uncovered that mystery, and after I did, for a solid 2 years, every single night, this album served as a soundtrack to my dreams. Much has been written about this album since its release. It's cited as an influence on a variety of contemporary musicians, and the nature of its recording has taken on a near-legendary status. But little has been heard from the principal players, especially Mark Hollis, who all but disappeared from the music industry since a self-titled album he released in 1998. The following are excerpts from a rare interview that Mark Hollis did with John Pidgeon, released as a promotional cassette in 1991. They give us some insight into the recording process, some of the inspirations that led to the sound of Laughingstock, and also act as a window into the mind of Mark Hollis. In this first excerpt, Mark Hollis details some of the ideas behind the recording process of Laughingstock.
The first time something is played, it is at its finest. And then the minute you try to recreate that, it becomes an imitation of something that was originally Bethnal. So all it is, it's just working along that line, but also saying, well, the problem with a lot of improvisation is that it meanders away from the point too much. So the thing that this time afforded us was to sort of go in with people that we wanted to play with purely from foremost from an aptitude point of view, give them absolute freedom in terms of what they play, but then just so that everything that they do play is free form, but then to construct an arrangement by taking little sections of that and building it up from there, you know. But that takes a large amount of time because, you know, maybe you're sort of 10 hours playing back on something, you know, to get a few seconds. 90% of what you play will be rubbish. There will only be, you know, if you're improvising, if you get 10%, which is any good, I think you're doing really well. I think you're doing amazingly well. If you get 0.5%, I think you're doing really well. So that's why I think this thing with the time limit of Spirit of Eden and Laughingstock lengthens out more is just because of that. With this one, there's been a very conscious effort to get away from conventional songwriting things. So if you sort of look at the first track up there, Merman, there is no part of that track which will ever repeat itself. You know, if you move into the second track, each verse that you move through cuts by a bar. It's increasingly getting shorter as the bit that's going on the back is getting longer and the vocals are shifting their position with reference to the bar. You know, it's just to get away from, you know, like this kind of frustration you get of, you know, fitting into moulds. The reason that Merman's up the front of this album is because, well, one thing we wanted to get away from is this thing where there's a tendency to look at albums in the same way like you would sort of a live concert, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, you just go in there hard on the first track up, you know. I would think the majority of albums, you know, you sort of put on that first track side one, and it's like if you like that track, you like the album. If you don't like that track, you won't like the album. You know, I don't like that as a way of thinking about albums. I think albums, in order to work properly, you know, they should work throughout. You shouldn't look at one track. The reason for putting that up the front is just, If you're looking in classical terms at things, you know, when the thing starts, it doesn't necessarily have to attack you. What it does is, for the first few minutes, it's there just to create a mood from which it then develops from, you know. So it was just thinking of it along those terms. I think that track is the most eclectic track for me. I think it's sort of as sort of most of the areas that I would like all existed within it. Yeah. Also like the way, you know, with the sort of drum part on that, I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know whether you know that thing, In a Sentimental Mood, the John Coltrane thing, But it's like the kit in the back of that, you know, it sounds like the bloke's setting his kit up while it's going on, and that's very much what I like with the drum track on that. Sounds like he's actually putting his kit together, ready for the second track. Yeah.
In the second excerpt, Mark Hollis talks about the musicians on Laughingstock, particularly Tim Freeze Green and Lee Harris, and also gives some of his thoughts on musical legacies and the sound of the record.
There are days when you know certain people are coming in to play, but around them it would be, you know, just absolutely whatever you fancy playing that day. You know, and above everything, you're asking them to play in a way that is completely natural to themselves. You know, and I think that's something which for a lot of people is unusual, because I'm sure with a lot of people, you know, they sort of say, well, look, I like his playing, and then they get hold of him and say, well, look, you know, could you play like you played there? That's not really what it's about. You know, you play as you feel. And this is the thing, you see, that the people that we work with on these albums, although I think technically they're very capable people, that is not the most important criterion. I mean, why we use them is for the way they are, you know, and it's just the attitude of the person. That's all it's down to. You know, basically whether or not we think they're a decent bloke, I mean, that's really it. When you're working on this improvisation thing, sure, there's a trust in that, you know, you trust the person for himself, and you know, you like what he plays. But I mean, you know, it's with anyone. I mean, there is trust within us, because certainly, like say with Freeze Green, I trust him as a producer. There is no question of that, you know, and my relationship with him as that is one that's built on trust. You know, and were I to work with another producer, that would take a long time to get that. There's no way I could have made this album with another producer. It's impossible, because, you know, Freeze Green is so important to what this album is. He is as much a part of it as anyone. And yeah, sure, there is trust within all the people we work with. Yeah, definitely there is. But it cannot be trust, you know, that everything you play is going to be right. I mean, it cannot be that. The optimum thing anyone can hope for is that music exists outside of the time in which it's written. For me, the only way you can do that is to make it as honest as it can, and that is true of the sound. If you start stylizing sounds, then it will become, you know, rooted to an actual period. You know, if you just have the sound as honest as it is, then it cannot, you know, suffer that problem. That's one of the reasons, you see, where we would look to use in a studio like Wessex, which is an extremely large one, so that what you do is you give perspective to the instruments by a physical distance from which you mic, you know, not from a board with echoes and that, because this thing of instruments sounding the way they are and having their true character, I think, is really important. I think that's also true, you see, from a vocal point of view. And definitely for me, you see, the most important album that I was listening to before we went in from a view of vocal sound would have been New Morning, the Bob Dylan album of 72. Because there, if you're talking about sounds being honest, I mean, I don't think you can get much more honest than that. It just sounds, you know, like the band's in the front room with you. Everything is set up, every instrument will be set up so that any point when, and it will be permanently set up so that any point when you actually felt like trying something, you can just go out and try it. I mean, it is a very fluid thing. Everything would be very loose in the studio. We would just go in with a basic framework of what the song would be. On the ones where drums exist, I mean, Lee would know what he's about. And then, you know, there would just be the basic chord shape and the vocal line. That would be it. And then you see, you know, within that, across these tracks, there would be two different ethics to what Lee would go in drum-wise. One would be looking back to Tego Mago, the Can album, that what a drummer does is he just locks in, he just plays regardless of anything that happens around him, and he never, you know, never stops. He has to be faded out. He's just like his own, you know, his own entity. But then you see also that's what's so true of this album for me, as opposed to any other, that you know, the people within that are playing within these tracks all have a different understanding of what the onbeat is, what the offbeat is, what signature they're playing in. They all just work within their own little field, and at points, you know, they meet up again, you know, they meet up with each other. But that is maybe, you know, the most important thing about this album for me is that everyone is in their own little time zone, you know. Yeah, time warp.
In our final excerpt, Mark Hollis discusses more about the attention to certain sounds on Laughingstock.
There's no way at the point when we go in that we know what this album will sound like. All we ever know, and this again would, you know, would be true of the previous album, is you just go in knowing what the attitude is you want, and that's it, nothing else than that. You know, there's no way I think you can ever go wrong on that, because there is no right and wrong. The right and wrong is only an internal thing. If you get on with it, then it's right. It's as simple as that. You know, that's why there can never be any disappointment at the end of making an album, you see. You know, you can't go wrong. You're in a faultless position here. I mean, people can hate it, but you personally cannot go wrong with it. If you take, say, you know, on that first track on Spirit of Eden, I mean, for me, those first two notes on the harmonica summed up what that album was for me. It was just not concerned about, you know, the number of notes. It was just concerned about the way those two notes were played, you know, and certainly it's true that I would say, you know, the most important thing for me about any record is you know, the silence is above everything, and I would rather hear one note than I would two, and I'd rather hear nothing than I would one note. You know, it definitely works that way. So, yeah, I mean, that sort of was Spirit of Eden, and then on this new one, if you look at sort of like the instrumental in After the Flood, which just plays a minute on one note, I mean, that again is the ethic. You're just talking about one note, but You feel the note. That's what's important. For me and Freeze Green, I would say that is without question the best solo that we've ever, you know, got together now. Just because, like I say, one note, that's it. But you just hit it hard. Two saxophones played a tone apart. Yeah, for just blowing on the one note. And then, you know, obviously I couldn't blow for a minute, but it's just, you know, cut across. Because, I mean, the idea with that, you see, was just, you know, I've just got this picture in my head, I don't even know how true it is, but of Roland Kirk, you see. I used to love those things where you saw him with two instruments in his mouth at the same time, and I just sort of imagine that would be about where he's at, you know. So always, to me, that was just like, you know, Roland Kirk, that section. As to whether he would ever play that, or I don't know, but that's like the image that I would have had in my mind about it. You know, technique has never been an important thing to me. Feeling is above, always has been and always will be above technique. So it's like, you know, a lot of the melodies that exist within this album are only like one note or two notes. It's no great hardship to actually play it, but it's just a question of whether, you know, it sounded right at the time. It's like quite often, you know, when people are in playing, that the stuff that we will get on with best is the, you know, the most simplistic. From the point of view of sort of where we're working, I think there's like an amount of work you have to do to actually realise what's within those albums. Maybe work at it is wrong. Maybe that's not the right word. All I mean is I just think you need to actually listen to it. That's all it is, that you don't do it while you're doing other things, because I just think you're not going to pick up on it. That's all it is, that you just sit there and do listen to it. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't require any kind of intellect, anything like that. No.
And now, just as Mark Hollis wished, we'll listen to Laughingstock in its entirety without interruption. Here is Talk Talk's masterpiece, Laughingstock, right now on KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot.
voicemail chair at the back room door. Help me up, I can't wait no more. Blessed love, the love I've seen. Stare by idle, stare faithful, powerful, second and fear. Starting home, half a mile. Track dependence beneath my feet. Step right up. should fasten.
As many times as I've heard that album, I still can't find easy ways to describe its sound. Often, when I would suggest that record to people, I'd just tell them that they need to hear it. And that's what we've done here in celebration of the 20th anniversary of Talk Talk's legendary album, Laughingstock. You just heard the entire album, start to finish. The tracks in the order that you heard them were Merman, Ascension Day, After the Flood, Taphead, New Grass, and the final track, I've never known how to pronounce it, but we'll just say it's called Rune. Laughingstock was the fifth and final album from Talk Talk, released on September 16th, 1991 in the UK and November 19th in the US, and so our tribute falls very nicely in between. Album was recorded over a period of 8 months at Wessex Studios in London, with Mark Hollis on vocals, guitar, piano, and organ, Tim Freeze-Green on organ, piano, and harmonium, Lee Harris on drums, and a host of 15 other musicians. It's still in print. In fact, just recently, Bada Bing Records issued the album, as well as Mark Hollis's final record from 1998, on vinyl for the first time here in the US, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Audio and playlists for today's show will be posted to meltingpotblog.com tomorrow, as well as some links to several articles about Talk Talk's Laughingstock. Links will also be posted to our Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/meltingpotradio, all one word. I sincerely hope you enjoyed this tribute as much as I did putting it together, and I especially want to thank all of you who supported this show and have been subscribers to KPFK in the past. Thank you dearly for your support and for the freedom that you've given us to produce tributes just like this. Until next time, y'all take care. I'll see you when I see you.